Welcome, folks, to The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Maher. Every week, diving deep into the truth of Catholic social teaching and restoring all things in Christ. The Uncommon Good, live from Iowa Catholic Radio's Mercy Live Up Studios.
The Uncommon Good is on the air. I'm Bo Bonner.
This is Bud Maher.
We are coming to you live. Us right now from America, but later on, Bud, on the show, we have someone from Austria. We are spanning the world on the show today. My name is Bo Bonner, of course, here in Des Moines, Iowa, where it's finally cooled off so that people my size can enjoy roaming around planet Earth. I'm coming to you from the Iowa Catholic Radio Mercy Live Up Studio. You can also catch me at thezetainstitute.com, where I'm the director of the Zeta Institute, a foundation of ethics and leadership, and also at mchs.edu, director of mission and ministry for Mercy College Health Sciences. Bud, what are you doing over in Pittsburgh?
Director of the National Institute of Newman Studies. If you want to find more, you can go to thenewmaninstitute.org.
And also, Bud is 1 year older as of yesterday.
Yep.
So that is, are you breaking down there, buddy?
Yeah, we almost had an arrested development type scene at my house yesterday because when I drove home into the driveway, I was still thinking about the lecture for the day. I taught at Duquesne. And when I walked in the house, five of my six kids jumped at me and yelled surprise.
Right.
And I guess on your birthday, you should be wary of those things. But I just thought, like, how traumatic it would have been if I would have collapsed right there.
That would be, really in your wheelhouse. Dying of surprise from children. That really goes into the nervous persona that you've crafted so well for yourself through the years.
Well, I turned 39, and, you know, Bo, as someone from the great state of Oklahoma and a graduate of Oklahoma State University, your head football coach has really entered birthday lore.
Yes.
Which is, I'm a man, I'm 40. I can't wait to bring that on social media next year.
That's right. You are still but a boy until next year. And you can start growing a mullet shortly thereafter. That's a good point. Well, for your birthday, I know we usually talk about this at the end of the first segment. For your birthday, I think I got you the present that you and I both wanted. When we started this show, we're talking about, because people ask us, you should do a show. We have to thank John Leonetti for this. But I think it's fair to say that we were asking, what should we talk about? And for you and I, the common good and Catholic social teaching had really been something swirling around in our heads and our hearts. And I would have to say that it's because of many things, but there's a website called The Josias. And The Josias is maybe the best website going, to my mind, about these issues. And the editor of that website is Pater Edmund Waldstein, Cistercian monk and vice rector of the seminary in, I'm going to mess this up, Heiligengruß, Austria. And, Bud, we have him on the show, and so I know for some people they might not know who this is, but I'm frankly dorking out that we finally got him on the show.
Yeah, that's great. Like you said, one of the best websites out there on these matters, and whenever I talk to folks like Potter, I feel pretty lazy, you know.
Yeah.
Cistercian monk, editor of a really important, you know, commentary site on the common good, and just a lot going on.
Right, like the only thing that I do, you know, vice anything is pretty much vice, so, but we don't need to talk about that.
Right.
As always, underwritten by Cartridge World, 801 73rd Street, Windsor Heights. Bud, we're in the height of maybe writing letters and printing out to everyone saying sorry about how our teams are doing in football. I don't know if we need to say anything more than that. But if you're running out of ink making excuses for your football team, Vikings fans, that this might be a really good place to go get some ink.
Sometimes I think I go too deep on the show for what we're being asked to do. But to me, I was thinking about Cartridge World in relation to theology.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, like so many of my students, like my interactions with them are over the interwebs these days.
Right.
And I kind of miss the, you know, like anti-Gnostic incarnationality of like holding a student's paper in my hand and being able to write that feedback, like where it's preserved for all time. So.
Right, yeah, those papers, when they're in your hand as papers, there's some other heresy, but certainly not Gnosticism.
Yeah,
maybe just barbarianism.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
515-564-7400, environmental printing. For business customers, there's pickup and delivery available.
And then always as underwritten also by the Mercy College of Health Sciences. Bud, we have our first Faith and Healing speaker coming up. This is going to be October 18th. 6 o'clock to 7:30, open to the public. Dr. May Sim. Dr. May Sim was my professor at Oklahoma State. Since we already kind of cater a little bit to theology and philosophy dorks anyway, student to none other than Alistair MacIntyre, the very brief time he was at Vanderbilt. I don't think he had too many students when he was at Vanderbilt University, but Dr. May Sim is one of them. Her specialty is Aristotle, then especially comparing Eastern and West. She has an entire book comparing Aristotle and Confucius about morals. It is fantastic. She's going to be talking about that again. Instances of Eastern and Western indifference to health. Zhuang Zhi, I know I messed that up too, and Epictetus, and I'm sure I messed that up too. But basically, if you want to hear about comparative Eastern and Western philosophy, specifically talking about health, indifference and understanding thereof, you gotta come to this, folks. October 18th, 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. I guarantee you it is going to be a fantastic talk, and it's someone else that I'm just, it's just a privilege and honor to get to have someone so formative in my life come to Des Moines and get to share their brilliance with everybody.
Hey, could I ask you a quick sort of like less, not personal question, but I was looking at the promotion for this talk by May Sim.
Mm-hmm.
And your posters like far outdid what I was doing in campus ministry.
That has nothing to do with me. I totally I turned that over to marketing.
We're
not even allowed to do the posters anymore.
I was like finger painting, and I mean, we were bringing in these hard hitting speakers, but it just wasn't up to snuff. So yeah, I didn't know if you had gotten like a second degree in graphic arts.
No. I Matt Romke, the vice president that's in charge of marketing and admissions and stuff, I'm like, do you want me to make something? And he's like, Lord, no, do not make anything.
It looks great. Folks, I would go to mchs.edu just to check out this poster that marketing designed.
Yeah, mchs.edu/faithandhealing, just spelled out, faith and healing,
okay.
And you can register there. So like I said, when we get back, what we think of as common good Catholic social teaching celebrity back on Potter Edmund. Join us after these messages. But I hope people are listening, because if you are, this is definitively the one that you're going to want to text in at. And how can you text in to ask us a question? The Zip Whip Line. 515-223-1150. That's 515-223-1150. If you want to catch our attention, hashtag UCG for the uncommon good. The Zip Whip Line. 515-223-1150. This is going to be a great interview. If you have questions, please let us know. If you want to confirm what Bud said, that like the people who do posters are much better than either Bud or I can ever do, anything you want, and also if the show's over, go ahead and leave something and we'll catch it next time. The Zip Whip Line, 515-223-1150. This is the Uncommon Good. Like I said, stick around when we get back. Potter Edmund all the way, reaching us from Austria. This is the Uncommon Good. We'll be back after this.
Everyone lives their life 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. How we use that time directly affects if our life will leave a significant impact or not. Every year, Blessman International leads teams of Central Islands on 12-day, all-inclusive experiences filled with life-changing personal interaction with the beautiful African children that we serve. Teams are forming now for 2019. Space is limited, so make a decision today to use your time to do something significant in the life of an African child. Learn more and apply for a trip today at www.blessmaninternational.org.
Thank you, Farm Bureau agent Cindy Schulte, for underwriting Catholic Women Now. As an authorized independent agent, Cindy's team can provide health insurance options from Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield of Iowa. Cindy Schulte at 1315 50th Street in West Des Moines, or on the web at cindyschulte.com. 515-226-2111. Cindy and her team know health insurance.
Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield of Iowa is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. Products available at Farm Bureau Financial Services.
Support for The Uncommon Good is provided by Cartridge World. Cartridge World is an industry leader delivering high-performance printing products that help you save time, money, and print great.
Perfect for businesses, home offices, college students, or busy moms trying to find affordable printing supplies, including ink, toner, paper, or printers. For business customers, pickup and delivery are available. Products are guaranteed or full replacement.
Cartridge World, your low-cost, environmentally friendly printing experts, 801 73rd Street in Windsor Heights, 515-564-7400, and online at cartridgeworld.com.
Builder Ken Construction. Not going along with the crowd will help you stand out in the crowd. Builder Ken Construction proudly supports Iowa Catholic Radio. Builder Ken Construction is a commercial general contractor providing pre-construction, estimating, and scheduling services through completion of construction. We can build projects ranging from tenant improvements and historical renovations to high-rise buildings. We build confidence. Learn more about the nearly 40 projects in the Des Moines metro area completed by Builder Ken Construction by visiting www.bdconstruct.com.
We're back with the Uncommon Good. Bo Bonner, Dr. Bud Maher. Today we have joining us from all the way across the world and someone important to us, like I said, the very foundation of our show. I think that we can safely say that his website that he edits, the Josias, J-O-S-I-A-S, was pivotal in us choosing the topic of the show. Potter Edmund Waldstein, Cistercian monk and vice rector of the seminary in, and forgive me, Father, Heiligenkreuz, Austria. And like I said, you can check out his writings at the Josias. Potter Edmund, welcome to the show.
Hello, I'm so glad to be here.
And I, you know, there's a long list of people I have to thank for even being able to talk to you on the internet that gets you here. It's all sorts of weird TAC people in Wichita, and then Matthew Peterson, Gabriel Sanchez, all these people I've literally not met in person. So as much as Bud and I can rail on technology on other shows, I want to thank Facebook and Twitter for making this moment happen. So thank you for coming on the show again.
Yeah, absolutely. Technology has its advantages as well as its disadvantages.
That's right. Well, and speaking of advantages and disadvantages, we want to talk about the good itself. You know, on our show, we try to make sure that we get topical about Catholic social teaching, the common good, talk about how it sort of shows up in practical, concrete ways in people's life. But we always take time every so often to reflect back to the most essential question. What is this common good that we keep bringing up, which makes us ask, what is the good? Or maybe another way to approach this is, if we want to have conversations with people about the good, you know, it's kind of hard. You can't ambush them, right? You know, they're getting a drink at the bar and you're like, hey, what about the common good? So what's maybe a natural way that really a discussion of the common good is, so to speak, lying in wait in nearly any situation?
Well, you can, excuse me, you can look at sort of the most, our most basic experiences of the good. If you look at a little child, you ask a little child, what's good? The child will probably give you a bunch of examples. He'll say, ice cream is good, pizza is good, vacation is good. These are kind of like very basic experiences of the good. And then if you look at what connects all those different experiences, what connects vacation and ice cream for a little child, they're all things that are desirable for the child. They're things the child wants, things he desires. So the first definition of the good that you get with Aristotle, who's the great philosopher who's so influential also on the Catholic understanding of the good, is that the good is what all desire.
And when you talk about this idea about desire, and like, so, okay, the good is something to be desired, you eventually have to say, someone goes like, well, yeah, it's good precisely because I desire it, right? Like anything that I want is good. And then we naturally go, well, no, you want to smoke 3 packs of Camels a day, and that's not ultimately good. So even the next order thing starts to ask these deeper sort of questions. Okay, so then if me merely desiring the good doesn't make it good, what does make it good?
Right. There has to be some reason in the thing itself that makes it desirable for me. There has to be something desirable about it. And one thing that makes something desirable is that it contributes to completing the life of the one who is desiring it.
Yeah, and when you start to think about what we mean when we talk about the good, and like the fact that so many people can think things that are ultimately bad for them are good, part of this is to say, you know, no one ever goes out and sets out to do bad. I always joke around that I grew up on 80s cartoons where all the bad guys love just being evil. And of course, this starts to make morality seem silly, because I don't think I've ever met anyone who's like, why did you do that? And you were like, for the evilness of it all. But it starts to show the precarious situation that we're all in. We assume if we want something that it's good, but that starts to be self-serving. So we have to start asking, what kind of good, or what kind of thing causes something to be good? And this is where, you would go into the idea that the good must be the final cause for the reason that you're doing something.
Exactly. So every time that you do something, you're doing it for some reason. You want to achieve something by doing it. And you can have a kind of chain of reasons why you're doing something. I'm going to the store in order to buy medicine, in order to improve my health. You may have noticed I have a bit of a cold. That's why I'm coughing the whole time. Sorry.
It's on your mind.
It's not ideal for a radio interview. But anyways, there you have a kind of a chain of different goals that I'm pursuing. And the final goal is going to be at the top of the chain. It's going to be what determines everything else. And if I can find out what really ought to be my final goal, what would really fulfill my life, then that will make that whole chain of goals reasonable. If I'm looking for what's really the good of my life. Whereas if I'm mistaken about it, if I think, you know, what's going to fulfill my life is to be rich and famous or something, then that makes my whole life be not good, because everything I'm doing is I'm doing for the wrong reason.
Potter, this is Bud Maher, and when I was growing up, I imbibed from a couple Sunday school teachers. So on the whole, I received pretty good formation, but you know, I've told students before that one message I kind of internalized growing up was you could boil down Christianity to don't drink, smoke, or chew, or go with girls who do. And it was sort of anti-desire. So when I was first exposed to Aristotle in college, I just ate it up because it seemed like consonant with Christianity, but also attuned to sort of like anthropology and how we're created as human beings. So if our listeners are tracking with what you've said so far, and it makes a lot of sense, does Aristotle give some advice on, okay, now I know that I desire the ultimate good, and I even am discerning in some sense like what might fulfill that. Like, how do we prudentially go about that? Because as Christians, we know, like, because of the burden of sin, that we've been thrown sort of into darkness and ignorance. And so how do we begin to identify the good and to discern different goods from each other?
Yeah, that's a really good point that you make about desire. Really, Christian life is about the most intense desires, the desires that are deepest in our hearts. And ultimately, Christianity is about the desire for God himself, who's infinitely desirable, infinitely good and beautiful, and the one for whom our hearts are aching, as it were. But you need a kind of education in desire. So you begin your life with kind of infantile desire. You have desire for food and drink and warmth and so on. And these are all good, but they're not the highest kinds of good. And so you need to be educated through habituating yourself to appreciate the goods that are more desirable, especially the goods that have to do with the more spiritual part of your person, the higher part of human nature, which is able to attain to something that is greater than, say, the good that, you know, the desire for food is able to attain to. So when you begin to get an appreciation for true beauty and for truth, the truth about the ultimate things, then you can see that there's a level of desire in the human soul that is to be discovered, that you don't automatically have as a little baby.
See, and I think this starts to be where the jump from desires that I have to this idea of, okay, well, where are we going to get to the common good, right? This idea of the good that somehow we all share. And I know that sometimes when you're talking to students who are unfamiliar with this, you go, okay, well, Aristotle sounds fine. We all have desires and we want to fulfill them. And they might even track with you to say, like, some are better than others, because some actually ultimately don't fulfill, they don't cash the check they write, to use a colloquialism. But they still go, like, all right, but how does this make us, you know, social creatures? How do we, is it always ultimately going to be conflict, or here are the common good? And they think, like, oh, so what you're saying is I have to do away with my desires and replace it with the desire for what everybody has in the state or the city or whatever. But actually, the claim of the common good is much more, it slides a middle path between both of those, pointing out that maybe the best way to say this, if I can truncate this, is we have desires that outstrip our own personal space, as it were. There's desires we have that we realize we can't accomplish alone. In this idea, yeah. If we're getting trained to have desires, is that something that, is it weirdly the spiritual realm that can awaken this idea of a communal desire that we have and can only be completed together with others?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you come to see that they're goods that you can desire, that you can only desire to have them together with others, that they're only able to be possessed together with others, and that, you know, these the more basic desires, like the desire for ice cream, which we began with, that's a desire for something that the more I have of it, the less someone else has of it. So if they're two boys and they've got, you know, a box of ice cream, the more the one gets, the less the other gets. That's typical for, you know, material goods, which are sort of the first goods that we know, because our knowledge begins with sensation, with tasting and seeing and smelling and so on. And those sensation has to do with that kind of good. But when we get to higher goods, we see that, in fact, the more I have, the more the other has as well. That they're goods that can be had in common without dividing them, without diminishing them. And you see this one example that I think many people experience is of a kind of common good that's common initially just between two people, namely love. If you look at Romeo and Juliet, the balcony scene, Juliet talks about how she's given her love to Romeo, and he asks her to give it again. And she says, well, I've already given it. But then she reflects kind of, and she says, this is the sort of thing that you can give and give and give. And the more you give it away, the more you have it.
That's all. Yeah, that's great, Potter. And, you know, in our context, as I have these conversations, even with other Catholics, like in America, it feels like one flow that we're kind of like rowing against is the ideas that have permeated our culture about a strict separation between, you could say, the state and religion, or public and private life. Even the divinity school that Bo and I went to, that is affiliated with like a Protestant tradition, Christendom was kind of a bad word, because there was this idea that Christians are, in a sense, imposing their idea about the world on other people. Do you have any thoughts or input on how we sort of like repropose the kind of robust conception of the common good that we're talking about, since so many individuals in our culture feel like that's sort of a threat to their way of life?
Right. Well, that I think that really comes from kind of a subjective understanding of the good, an understanding. So we say the good is that which all desire. But as you said at the beginning, that doesn't mean that it's our desiring that makes something good. Our desire is awakened by what is really good. So the presupposition of kind of modern politics, and unfortunately much of theology follows modern philosophy in accepting this presupposition, is that people just kind of arbitrarily desire what they want. And so you shouldn't so everyone should be left free to desire what they arbitrarily want, and you shouldn't try to interfere with that at all. The state shouldn't try to attain what's good for people. Instead, it should just kind of set the conditions so that each person can pursue what they happen to desire. But if you see that the good is really something that's in things, it's something objective, it's something that's calling to us from the being of the world, then it's something that we can discover together and pursue together. And in our common life, in a political community, we can really see what are the goods that really fulfill our lives as human beings living together. What is true justice and true peace, and how can we achieve that together?
I think one easy example of this that I've had, I mean, I'm not going to act like success. That sounds like I'm doing a great job. But it sparks a little bit of something in people's eyes when I point this out. There's a question about why do we have road signs and speed limits? So speed limits, right? what is the point of a speed limit? And under what the former thing, what you're saying, which I think we could call in liberal enlightenment, or, you know, that's a phrase that has its own problems. But just the sort of modern understanding of, like, we are free to desire whatever we want as long as it doesn't hurt other people. And so when you look at a speed limit, the idea is drive whatever you want unless it's over this speed because it might hurt others. And funny enough, what this really makes is morality into sort of like bean counting and behaving, right? Did you go 56? Did you make Leviathan mad and go over the speed limit it's set for you? But there's another way to look at that, which is to say, well, you put up speed limits because you want people to get in the habit of driving safely. And so 55 isn't some magical number. There's all sorts of reasons why you might need to go over 55. Someone's injured. You're late to church. Right. I'm just saying stuff, maybe. Not like it's my family life or anything.
Your wife's having a child.
Yeah. But then you start to go, well, no, actually what we try to do with laws is we make laws to try to make people a certain way. And it sounds weird at first until you think about it. Like, okay, we have laws prohibiting murder because we want to habituate a citizenship to not be murderers. And it almost sounds silly at first until you go, like, yeah, isn't that where you want to go? You want to go live in a place where people aren't in the habit of murdering. And sometimes I get people to start unmooring their vision of the common life when we talk that way.
Yeah, I think that's really an important point, that we should very consciously think about how we can help each other gain the habits that will enable us to attain the greatest goods. And that, I mean, in that example, that you see two ways of thinking about the same rule. But even if the state is not consciously trying to inculcate some habits, in fact, it will. So the there's kind of an unavoidable it's unavoidable that we will be pursuing some kind of conception of what's good for human beings in our political life. And so one way of looking at sort of trying to persuade people to abandon liberal and enlightenment conceptions of political life is to say, well, in fact, it's not realistic. Really, the state already is trying to habituate people to a way of life, trying with an implicit view of what's really good for human beings. And what we want to do is to make that explicit and try to find out what's the right way to habituate people and what is really the true good that we're all seeking.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, no, you actually clarified something for me, like, here on air. You can't avoid quote-unquote paternalism when you're making laws for people. The question is, are you being honest with everyone about what you're doing with a law? And that actually starts to explain a lot. Bud and I have tried to point this out in various venues, that whatever else you can say about modernity, there's assumptions of neutrality, right? Like, okay, well, you guys can all do what you want, but here's the neutral thing that is clear and transparent, and there's nothing about it. But if you take a step back, you start to go, No, it's just they've tried to make everything that used to be explicit implicit, and then you're left to say, well, is that like part and parcel of what the modern world tries to do, or is that, you know, I don't know, but it doesn't have to be nefarious, that's just what we're living in, and it's good cause for Christians to stop and think about that.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, a classic example of this is the so-called separation of church and state, where the state says, okay, we're not going to interfere in religion because, you know, this is a private matter that each person has to settle in the depths of their conscience with God and so on. But in fact, that very declaration of neutrality already includes a view of religion and, you know, what religion is and what kind of religion is good. And so there's no avoiding taking a position with respect to religion.
And so then, you know, they can play it off depending on what type of person you are. On one hand, if you are, like I said, malicious enough, this is an end around for like most any religious arguments. But it appeals to a sort of like, people don't want to be known as the like people who fight and cause division. You make appeals to unity, but it's a unity won by silencing certain groups of people. Like you said, which is unavoidable. Well, Father, we're coming up on the break. You're good to join us after these messages on the other side of the half hour?
Absolutely, yeah.
Wonderful. This has been a wonderful talk. This is This is going well. And Bud, we still got you on connection, right? You didn't go away?
No, I'm just I'm soaking it all in, so still here.
Okay, good. I didn't know if maybe you went and, you know, Pittsburgh fries with salad or whatnot.
I'm gonna resist.
we can talk about the common good of French fries.
This is the higher good, yes.
Okay.
Right.
So this is the Uncommon Good. We'll be back shortly after these messages. Like I said, we're talking with Potter Edmund all the way from Austria across the world. Stick around. We'll be back after these messages. Friends, there's all sorts of ways that you can stay connected with what's going on here in the Diocese of Iowa and also with Iowa Catholic Radio. The obvious thing you need to know about, of course, is Christ Our Life is coming up this weekend. Iowa Catholic Radio has me interviewing people as they walk by, of course, the big-name speakers, but also, hopefully, people that are just enjoying and out and about and everything like that. If you want to keep up to date with all that we're doing, and even maybe something like Iowa Christ Our Life and what we're doing out there, you can go on Facebook and follow us, Iowa Catholic Radio, our Twitter handle, at IA Catholic Radio. And then also, we have our bi-monthly newsletter so that you can keep in tune. And like Bud is often fond of pointing out, you can go look at the bottom there and sign up and register for many things. We just had the men's stag, and I know people signed up that way. Christ Our Life coming up this weekend. Keep following us on Facebook and Twitter. And like I said, Iowa Catholic Radio or at IA Catholic Radio. And then when we broadcast, if you can't hear us on the radio waves, www.iowacatholicradio.com. Stick around. We'll be back with the Uncommon Good.
Everyone lives their life 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. How we use that time directly affects if our life will leave a significant impact or not. Every year, Blessman International leads teams of Central Iowans on 12-day, all-inclusive experiences filled with life-changing personal interaction with the beautiful African children that we serve. Teams are forming now for 2019. Space is limited, so make a decision today to use your time to do something significant in the life of an African child. Learn more and apply for a trip today at www.blessmaninternational.org.
Vitae Family Care is part of the Iowa Catholic Radio family. Pro-life physician Greg McKernan, a DO, has practiced for 27 years, seeing patients of all ages with just about every kind of need. Dr. McKernan lives his faith as a physician and is trained in NAPRO technology, allowing him to diagnose and treat many female conditions and even markedly reduce the occurrence of a miscarriage. VitaeFamilyCare.com. Remember, Vitae is Latin for life.
Support for the Uncommon Good is provided by Cartridge World. Cartridge World is an industry leader delivering high-performance printing products that help you save time, money, and print great.
Perfect for businesses, home offices, college students, or busy moms trying to find affordable printing supplies including ink, toner, paper, or printers. For business customers, pickup and delivery are available. Products are guaranteed or full replacement.
Cartridge World, your low-cost, environmentally friendly printing experts, 801 73rd Street in Windsor Heights, 515-564-7400, and online at cartridgeworld.com.
Have you heard? I thought you might ask. Iowa Catholic Radio's Fall Carathon is just around the corner. We'll be broadcasting live all day from October 15th through the 19th with a fantastic lineup of Catholic programming, and I want you to be a part of it. You see, our mission here is to save souls. It's a responsibility that we take very seriously. However, we can't do it alone. We need you. God needs you. Our Fall Carathon is a big part of that mission. So from October 15th through the 19th, make sure you tune in and listen. That's all I ask. As always, thanks for listening to Iowa Catholic Radio, and may God bless you.
Back with the Uncommon Good, Bo Bonner, Dr. Bud Marr. We have joining us, like I said, from Austria across the world, Potter Edmund Waldstein, Cistercian monk and vice rector of the seminary in Heiligenkreuz. You know, Father, I heard my commercial where I don't even say environmentally right, so I had no chance saying that right. But seminary in Austria, you can check out his writings at the Josias, that's Josias. Potter, thanks for coming back on the show.
So glad to be here.
On the top of the hour, we've been talking about the good, getting to the common good. Neutrality, like the idea of the good that hides behind the neutrality of the state, paternalism. And we've talked a lot in 30 minutes. So to sort of reintroduce what we're getting at, the Catholic understanding of the common good and most of Catholic social teaching deeply talks about desire, the question of what do we desire most. Obviously, we have the desires that are in front of us, the material ones. I like ice cream. It's good. But then we have, of course, the higher ones, and the highest being friendship with God.
Yeah.
Everything in between starts to be a question of ethics. What should we want? How should we want it? In what order? et cetera, et cetera. So we start coming to the idea of the common good. Where is it that we that you think okay, I think people desire the common good, but they never name it that, and when they get to sort of trying to talk about it, they run out of words for doing so. Do you have any idea why that starts to be so hard for us to talk about in the modern era, and then maybe ways to start bringing it up?
Well, in the modern era, you get a view of the good as being sort of primarily as the primary thing as being my desire itself, rather than the object, what's really good in itself. So you see this already in the late Middle Ages. You have thinkers who are beginning to get kind of a subjective view of reality and de-emphasize the objectivity of the good. And you see this even with in their theology. You get them talking about God as being kind of arbitrary in what he commands. And so you get a view of the good as being one of these views that you get is sort of the good is just what God commands. And what he commands happens just, you know, it's arbitrary. He happens to command, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery. But if he commanded the opposite, thou shalt kill, thou shalt commit adultery, then that would be what would be good. And that leads you to an idea of morality as being about the duty of following some kind of rule. So in Enlightenment philosophers, for example, in Immanuel Kant, you have the idea that it's selfish to desire happiness. It's selfish to desire something for yourself. And what's good, what is moral, is to follow some kind of universal moral law. So there's a kind of a division there that takes place between desire and morality. And that has very much to do with a loss of the understanding that to desire our fulfillment, to desire our happiness, is to desire a common good. It's to desire something that we share with others.
And I think that that starts to be something that is really hard for people to understand at first, but that we have to get at is the desire for the common good is a personal one. It's not you submitting your desires or putting them on the back burner for the sake of others. What we're trying to talk to people is if we talk about the robustness of our desire, there's actually a way in which maybe the reason you feel unfulfilled, even though you live in a world where like there's all sorts of ways to fulfill personal desire, virtually, online, in person, 17 different flavors of Oreo, whatever it might be, what right. starts to happen is, and I think I'm stealing this from Simon Lace, is you have desires that outstrip the reality of yourself. And so you go asking, where can I fulfill this desire that I haven't felt met? Now, obviously, this starts to talk about the spiritual realm and our relationship with Jesus Christ, but there's also a very human one that we can't fulfill on our own. And if we don't start to be, like you were talking about in the first half of the show, habituated to an actual social desire that we can only have with others together, it's no wonder so many people walk around our world feeling existentially unfulfilled and not knowing why.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of two opposite misunderstandings of the common good that you end up getting in modern politics. And one is the one that we've already talked about, namely the liberal misunderstanding that sees the common good as really just being sort of a set of conditions that will help each person to achieve their private desires. Each person will be free to, you know, pursue 17 flavors of Oreos or whatever it is that they happen to want. And the common good is just sort of a name for a set of social conditions that enable each person to pursue that. But the opposite desire, the opposite error about the common good is what you see in modern totalitarianism. So often this is what people are afraid of when they hear us talking about the common good and they say, oh no, you know, this is going to be totalitarian. And what totalitarianism does is it discounts the individual's own desires and the own end and says everything has to be subordinated to a greater whole, right? So you've got the nation, or you know, the working class, or you know, there's this some abstract whole that is a really important thing, and everything has to be sacrificed to the good of that. So, you know, you have to. There's in you see this very clearly in German National Socialism. There's this kind of idolatry of the nation, and everyone, you know, it's noble to subordinate everything to that, and the personal fulfillment is not important. But the true position about the common good falls into neither of those errors. The true position is that what really fulfills us as persons, what really fulfills the deepest desires of my heart as a human being, is a good that I share with others. So if we together are pursuing the good, then that's something that it's – so I'm there's a kind of subordination of my private goods to that common project that we have together. I should, you know, be willing at times to give up some private advantage for the sake of the common good. But it's for the sake of a good that's really my good, in the sense that I am the one who benefits from it. I'm the one who attains to the peace and virtue that we're pursuing together.
Father, as a priest, I know that, you know, the celebration of the Mass is at the heart of your ministry and your life. And sometimes I worry that even as Catholics, we have kind of a voluntaristic conception of being present at the liturgy where, you know, it's good to see that obligation as a command that binds us. But the liturgy also shapes our desires. And I don't know, and I don't want to be like too, we don't turn the liturgy into like a pedagogical thing only. But could you talk some about, like, with what you were just saying about seeking a common desire and you know, like turning towards the same good, how does the liturgy play a role in our lives and shaping our desires correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a great question. There are kind of two sides of the common good. There's the part of it that is up to us in a way, that we realize together, that is the peace and virtue that we attain together, the knowledge of the truth and the enjoyment of it. But then the common good is a good that's not up to us at all. And that is the source of all goodness. That's God himself. Everything that's good about creation is good because it's in some way a participation in God, who's the creator. And God is the good whom we are made to desire. We've been created to desire God. And when we come to know him in some way, we know him as a good that is infinitely greater than us, and in a way infinitely exceeds our desire, so that the desire for God is never a desire to subordinate God to me, to make God an instrument to my own happiness. But our happiness is found in a way in letting go of our private concerns and, adoring God, putting ourselves below him. This is what really fulfills us and makes us happy. And finally, it's the desire to give ourselves to him, to give ourselves entirely to God. And that's what the liturgy is all about. The liturgy, the pinnacle of the liturgy is the celebration of the holy sacrifice of the Mass, which is, and sacrifice is a giving. It's a giving of something to God. In the English word sacrifice, of course, comes from the Latin sacrificium, which means to make something sacred, which means to give it to God by laying something on the altar. You know, you're giving it. It's a sign of giving it to God. And finally, what we want is to give ourselves to God. And the ancient pagan sacrifices, they were all symbols of the people giving itself to God. They would sacrifice an animal, and that animal would be a stand-in for themselves. But in the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, we really are able to give ourselves to God through the gift that our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, made on the cross. He gives himself to God and expresses that gift in his willingness to give up his life on the cross. And then in the Mass, we are united to him so that we can become part of that sacrifice, so that our lives can be given to God. And when we receive Holy Communion, that is in order to unite us to the victim of this sacrifice, to become part of his body so that it is we who are being offered to the Father on the altar. And that is the highest participation in this life that's possible in the highest good and last end, which is God himself.
I actually have a fantastic example of this. I get the chance to teach high schoolers great books, and we're reading Beowulf. And funny enough,
oh great,
yeah, Grindel. Why does Grindel hate what's going on at the Mead Hall and decides he wants to kill all of the Ring Danes? Well, because they're singing with joy, and particularly songs about the goodness of creation. So Grindel, descendant of Cain, right, like sort of stand-in for all things that have like turned in on themselves and become, you know, heavy with sin. Grindel can't take the common good that is brothers singing together in joy about the gift of creation they've been given. And so Grindel feels compelled to go and destroy this ability for the common good to exist. Now, I'm sure that's not what the people writing Beowulf had in mind, necessarily, like thinking about it in those sort of philosophical terms. But to me, that's what's going on. And when we talk about the common good, it's not a matter of you putting your desires on the back burner. It's actually that you're not desiring enough. It's almost like you're making a bad bet. You're making a bad investment, investing in your desires alone, instead of investing it in a treasure that can't go away, right, with God and his people. And ultimately, I think this comes back right to Augustine talking about the city of man and the city of God and the conflict between their desires. The common good in Catholic social teaching ultimately is about desire, and I think that might strike a lot of people as surprising, but it's inescapable, it seems.
Yeah, it really is inescapable. But, I mean, that figure of Grindel, he shows that in order to liberate the greatest desires and the most satisfying desires, there is a certain amount of death to self that's necessary, because each of us has this kind of Grendel in his soul. There's a disordered desire that comes from the wound of original sin that's in us. And so this is why sacrifice takes on, after sin, sacrifice does take on a certain aspect of pain as well. There is a certain amount of giving up that's necessary. And the holy sacrifice of the Mass enables us to do that, to give up the old man, to give up the Grendel who's, you know, got these disordered desires in our heart, and to discover the true desire, the desire for what's really good. There is a certain amount of pain and asceticism that can't be separated from the Christian life, but it's a pain that is at the service of a greater happiness, a greater joy, and so it's worth it to suffer that pain in order to attain to the infinite joy of being with God.
Potter, I think that's an essential point, and I was wondering if you could just elaborate a bit more on asceticism, because one thing I first struggled with when I first entered the church was, when we think about asceticism, like mistakenly in my mind, I thought it was like giving up something that was sort of bad, you know, but asceticism actually doesn't have that tenor. Like these things are good. Like someone who chooses celibacy for the sake of the kingdom, they're giving up the good of marriage, or fasting, giving up the good of food for a time for a certain purpose. Like, how do we kind of understand asceticism properly in relation to this broader discussion about desiring rightly?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything that God has created is good, and the human heart is created by God in such a way that it's only able to desire things insofar as it sees them as good. I think you were talking about this a little bit earlier with the 1980s cartoon villains, that in reality there's no one who wants to do something simply because it's evil. Every time you do something, even when you're sinning, even when you're choosing something that is in fact evil, you're choosing it, as it were, under the aspect of its being good. So maybe I kill one of my confreres here in the monastery, I poison his soup or something, right? This is evil. But I'm choosing it under the aspect of some apparent good, right? Then I won't have to have this annoying confrere of mine.
You can tell us, because this is U.S. radio, so you're fine. You're out of it's out of jurisdiction.
Yeah. Hopefully I won't act on this temptation.
Yeah, right.
So what needs to happen in order to properly enjoy the good and properly be awakened to the goodness of all the things that God has created for us is not to not to root out the desire for the good, but to correct it and to order it in the right way and to desire things for the right reason. And sometimes that will mean, as it were, if it's like our soul is like a bent stick. Aristotle talks about this. And sometimes in order to get a bent stick to be straight, you need to bend it a bit in the opposite direction. So, for example, if I drink too much wine, if I'm a drunkard, wine is something good in itself. When you use it well as a means to sociability and to increasing your joy with others and so on, but obviously it can become very destructive if you use it in the wrong way and drink too much of it at the wrong times and so on. And so sometimes in order to correct that desire, you will have to say, okay, I'm not going to drink any wine at all. And that's not because wine is something bad, but it's because there's something bent in your desire and you're trying to fix that. With celibacy, something even a little bit different is going on. It's not even if you don't have a disordered love of women, you can still want to be celibate. And the reason there is to be a sign that all created goods are finally only a participation in the uncreated good, which is God. So the fact that as monks we give up marriage and love with a woman and passing on life in the family, which are things that are very good, that has to do with the desire to be a sign that the true happy ending is not when the guy gets the girl at the end of the movie, but the true happy ending is when we attain to God. And so there's a way of giving up earthly goods in order to be a sign for the final good that we'll have in heaven.
Well, Father, we're running out of time. I have to make an observation that I've noticed. I'm an oblate with the Benedictines over here in Clear Creek in Oklahoma. So I've read the rule. I heard you talk, and I realized monks always talk about poison when people are dying. It's always poison. And I just have a new theory about this. Right? They try to kill Benedict twice. Always poison. I think poison is sort of like when you live as a monk long enough, poison is such a great way to think about sin and death. It's not so much like a frontal attack. Sin is more like poison. And what it does is it gets in us and then it starts spreading. And the poison of sinful desire is not like it's at its worst, not when it's just knocking you over the head, but when it seeps deep down in you. And so that's my new theory that I just came up with, why monks always talk about poison. So I'll leave you with that, Father. I don't know if we have a lot of time to really work that one out. But, Father, this has been, like I said, a dream come true. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been fantastic. If people want to either read a bit more from you or maybe go down the road a bit more learning about some of this, is there places they should look?
Yeah, well, you mentioned already a couple times the josias.com. That would be the place to start. We also have a podcast, actually. Another episode was just released yesterday, so you could also check that out if you like listening to podcasts.
Well, thank you very much. Like I said, it's been an honor, a pleasure. Thank you very much, Padre Edmund Waldstein, for coming on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, too. It was so great being here.
Yeah.
Well, Bud, we've run to the very end of the show, but I thought it was worth it. And if it was up to me, we would talk even less just to make sure. So just to say, this is the uncommon good. May Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, reign in our hearts and our families, our city, our state, our nation, the entire world, all the galaxy, all living things, all reality. The uncommon good will join you next week. Man, Bud, I mean, that was... this is one of my favorite shows. I wish we could talk more about it, but let's talk about things that people can do if they want to participate in the common good of Iowa Catholic Radio. What's one way they can do that by listening on the station?
I would encourage you to wake up early to catch the Bible in a Year. At 5 a.m., that transitions to the Rosary, And then Father Andrew Winchettle has a gospel reflection immediately afterwards. That's repeated again at 9:30, minus the Bible reading, but still the prayer at 9:30 p.m.
And all around the diocese, so much going on. I think the obvious one that we need to talk about, of course, is Christ Our Life coming up this weekend. If you can't make it, we will be interrupting program throughout the weekend, doing interviews with some of the speakers and other people. So that's Christ Our Life, September 29th through 30th. So make sure to tune in. If you're not already going there, tune in, and you can hear about it. We have a Ladies' Mosaic Luncheon coming up October 11th. And then again, the Fall Carathon, October 15th through 19th, a place where you can help our ministry be furthered by participating in funding the show so that it can be heard 24/7 through walls everywhere we go. And then one last pitch just to let everyone know that October 18th, at Mercy College of Health Science, like I said, we have the Faith and Healing speaker, Dr. Mae Sim. Go to mchs.edu/faithandhealing. We would love to have all of you there. Bud, man, we're just lucky people that we get to have conversations like that. It's a great show.
No, that was great. And real quick, so you're gonna try to talk to some of the speakers at Christ Our Life?
Yeah, they supposedly have it all listed out for me.
Man.
So we'll see how that goes.
See if you can get Bishop Barron and talk about Von Balthasar.
Yeah, no, I think we... I don't think we need to start fights.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll probably avoid all of that. So,
yeah.
All right, bud, keep trucking out there in Pittsburgh and tell everyone out there that, you know, we love them. And, hey, maybe we can play out there sometime, too. So, God bless, bud. Happy birthday.
All right. Thank you, sir.
The Uncommon Good. Talk to you next week.
The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Maher is heard every week on wonderful Catholic stations like this one and anytime on podcast. Just search for The Uncommon Good.